Okay, we can start. First of all, I'm Jim Knutson. My wife and I spent nearly 18 years in South Africa as missionaries, and then I was a staff member for the ALC and then the ELCA from 73 through the end of last year. So we have some perspectives on Africa, South Africa, we'd like to share. Obviously, no one knows a lot. It's a terribly complex situation. So we'll start now, and we can roll the tape. What we're going to do today is have a general overview, and that's a scary thing to do too, of the situation in South Africa. We'll end up by looking at slides, which are an overview. The title today is Resistance and Hope. In a sense, what I want to do is focus mainly on the church, meaning our Christian sisters and brothers in Southern Africa. And that really has been the theme of the church's ministry, and that's not an original thing with me. There are books called Resistance and Hope, Desmond Tutu's collection of sermons called Suffering and Hope. The church in South Africa has carried on its ministry of word and sacrament, of preaching and teaching, and all the kinds of things that any church does anywhere. At the same time, it's been involved in the struggle. Its people are in the struggle, and so it has been a voice of protest and a voice of resistance and active resistance, even though obviously the church's record in South Africa is a mixed one, just like it is any place. But today, an overview. Tomorrow, how did South Africa get the way it is? Some perspectives. Obviously, you could have a month seminar on that one and not finish. And then the next day, what is the church doing? So today, it'll be an overview. I'd like to say, if you have any questions, you know, feel free to ask them. And if I think we're going to be dealing with them the next couple of days, we'll try to perhaps defer some of them, because we do have two more days. Also tonight, there's going to be an open forum on the situation in South Africa. There are a number of good books in the bookstore that I'd like to mention now. God in South Africa by Albert Nolan. This book is helpful for any one of you who is dealing with, is involved in ministry anywhere in the world, especially anything cross-cultural, but in any place where there's any kind of oppression, any kind of problem, whether you're in New York or Boulder or Minneapolis or Seattle, this is a helpful book and very really will stretch you. A book which gives, it's God in South Africa. I'll leave it up here and you can see it afterwards. It's in the bookstore. Another one written by John DeGruchy is in the bookstore. His daughter is with us and she'll be on the panel tonight. She's a volunteer here, Janelle DeGruchy. Church Struggle in South Africa. The one in the bookstore is a later edition, has a different cover. But this is the history, the story, a very well told story of the church by John DeGruchy, who is a professor at the University of Cape Town, a South African white who has been involved in the struggle. Very, very helpful history if you're interested in that. South Africa's Moment of Truth by Ted Lockwood, who used to be the head of Washington Office in Africa. A good summary of the whole situation. If you're interested in a quicker summary, don't want to get into too many details. And then one that we'll be talking about mostly the last day, my last day on Saturday, about mutuality, two-way street and mission, Gifts and Strangers by Anthony Gittens, a Roman Catholic who teaches at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. Here again, if you're involved in any way in anything cross-cultural, if you're dealing with Native Americans, with Hispanics, with Blacks, with anyone different from you in ministry, this book will challenge you, will stretch you. He talks about what it means to be a stranger in another culture, and that may be going, it may be going across the street, it may be going across the ocean. This man has been used now to help orient ELCA missionary personnel going overseas. That's how much we think of him. So Gifts and Strangers. It's a tough book. I'm still working through it. I got to go through it again, but maybe more than once. But I would highly recommend it. Okay, just some background, and then we're going to look at the slide. But I'd like to start out with a quote from a professor in Cape Town who is a close colleague of John DeGruchy, Charles Villavicencio, professor of religion, Christianity there. He wrote in Sojourners in 1988, September, there was a special issue on South Africa called The Church Confronts Apartheid. among other things, in his little article which says the struggle for the church's soul, I don't think Christians in the United States or in other parts of the world are really in a position to minister to us until they have dealt with the fundamental issues of racism and economic injustice within their own countries. One of the major reasons why the present regime in South Africa continues to exist is because of the good services rendered to this regime by the United States. The South African regime is what it is because of the resources for the multinationals in your country, which sustain, develop, and get rich off our economy. Now, you may agree or disagree with this man, but that's his perspective as a white South African battling the system. Then, what you are witnessing in South Africa is not some sort of a strange society or aberration. It is, in fact, a microcosm of what is happening globally. Just as first world nations are wealthy and prosperous as a result of the poverty of third world nations, in South Africa we have one nation in which the wealth of the whites is a direct consequence of the poverty and oppression of blacks. So that's something I'd like you to remember, if we're together for these days, that South Africa is a mirror, should be a mirror for us. That we are concerned about the situation there. There are things that are wrong and not right, and we should be concerned and angered. At the same time, we need to look at our own situation, and my hope is that as we look at a situation like this, we will begin to be more aware of oppression and injustice in our own country, where there is plenty of it, where in some ways, we were talking the other day, in some of our cities, probably the situation is much worse now than it was 30, 40 years ago, and the racial situation too. And the other thing is South Africa is a microcosm of the world where a minority of whites control the wealth. And you can say there are many reasons why they do and all that, but the fact is they do. And the majority of black people are not in on this, and that's the way it is in our world today. And again, there are reasons for that, but it's a microcosm of the world. Just a couple of things about South Africa as background. The population, about 36 million now, and when you talk about South Africa, you need to break it down. You say, well, why talk about this when it's all one people, and the aim is to have one people, but to make sense of the situation and the dynamics, you need to see this. This is the latest I've seen. There may be other estimates, but I think it gives you an idea. 27 million blacks, a little over 3 million coloreds. Coloreds are mixed race. We would call them mulattoes. And they are a classified group of people. And I realize some of you know a lot about South Africa here. Some of you have been there probably. Anyone here been in South Africa? So, you know, I don't want to insult intelligence, and yet just some of the basics. Asians, about 1 million, came from India to work in the sugar plantations originally. And whites, 5 million, about 60%. Out of Dutch background, there's some German and French in there, and about 40% of British background, that's changing too. So about 36 million. But 14% of the people have 87% of the land. This map, the map of the homelands. You can't see the detail, but you can see the different colors. There are 10 ethnic homelands in South Africa called Bantustan's homelands. 10 of them, different colors. That's about 13% of the land. Very similar to the Indian reservations in the States in many ways. There are differences, obviously, but there are similarities. The big ones, the ones you've heard about more often, Transkei, KwaZulu, which is many, many different pieces of land, not one contiguous piece. Bophuthatswana, Tswana, all these different pieces, and one piece down here, because many years ago, some Tswana fled. They were in a fight with another group, and they fled down here and stayed down here. So that's a part of the Bophuthatswana homeland. Lebowa, another fairly large one. Vanda, well known to Lutherans, where Dean Farsani comes from. Kazankulu, Kangwane, Kwandebele, Kwakwa, Siskai. There are 10 of them. Each place has a different language. We'll come back a little bit to that, but that's the land distribution. Some other basic facts, the health situation now. Infant mortality right now is 10 times higher for blacks than for whites. 50% of the black babies, children die before the age of 5 in some of the homelands. The average per capita income now is 14,800 rand for a white and about 1,246 for a black. That varies. There are places that are paying the same salary in some, but this is how it averages out. And this is, and these are some of the things that need to be worked on as they work on a new nation. Doctor-patient ratio of 400 to 1, 90,000 to 1. Some of the pillars that are still in place, and we'll be talking a little bit about that again tonight, the fact that there are changes, negotiations are taking place. Mandela has been freed, the ANC and PAC and Communist Party and so forth have been unbanned. Talks are taking place. But the basic pillars of this whole thing, and tomorrow I want to talk more about that history, are in place. The Land Act of 1913 and then 1936, which buttressed that system. No black can buy land in another place. That's the land situation. Group areas, 1950. If you're Zulu, you live in a Zulu place. If you're Xhosa, you live in a Xhosa place. And even if you come to town, there are sections in the townships in Soweto for the different ethnic groups. Now you can get, you can intermarry and that happens. Population registration, you're registered according to one of these four groups. That's who you are, and that determines your a lot of things in life. Homeland citizenship, 8 million people were citizens of the homelands which became independent, and they lost their South African citizenship. That's going to be worked on. Influx control, you needed a pass to go into town. And you could be picked up on the street at any time, and it was common to see the police vans loaded with people going to jail because they'd been picked up for past laws. Now that's been amended, but there are two new laws, the Aliens Act of 1978 and the Squatters Act as recent as 1989, so it's still very difficult to move around in the country for a black person. Another pillar, Bantu education, 1953. Education for the Africans is different from the white because they've got a different life. And it was said at that time, they need to be educated to be our servants, to be hewers of wood and drawers of water, and they don't need our kind of education. That's another thing that's being wrestled with. Internal Security Act and all kinds of other acts where people can be picked up, detained without trial. It's estimated there are 3,000 political prisoners yet. The estimates run from 1,000 to 3,000, and it's always hard to get the real figure because the government usually puts it low, and maybe some of the other people put it high, maybe it's in the middle. But these are people detained for political reasons, not because they've done something, I mean, a criminal offense. So there is this security still in place. That's some of the background. There's a lot more that could be said, a lot more that a lot of you know. But it's against that background now, and I'll come back to it a little bit in some of the slides. We'll look at the slides. If you have questions during the slides about something, the slides are going to be over there. Pipe up, and as I said, we can answer it, we will, and if not, while we're answering your question, can someone get the blinds, please? Yeah, please.
I was just curious, do we in the United States hear so much more about South Africa because it has the high percentage of white population? I mean, are there corridors to the other countries in Africa? I mean, we don't know much about South Africa, but we know more than probably all the other countries. Is it totally different from the other countries in Africa?
Yeah, it's different in the sense that, you're right, that it has the highest percentage of whites. That's one. And it's there are lots of injustices, and we can, you know, take Africa and we can take country by country. It is the only country right now where, let me put it starkly, a Christian people has encoded into law a system which governs by the color of your skin. And of course for us as Lutherans, there's a large Lutheran church. That's another reason. We have been in relationship with that church. Just like in Namibia, where Solvay is talking about, where this Lutheran church has been in dialogue with us through these years and has brought, so as Lutherans we've probably gotten more. But even in the papers, I think the fact is also economically it's very important. Strategically it's been important. So there are other reasons too. Okay, we'll go to the slides. I'll turn this on. Please, you know, if you have a question, I'm going to use a script that I wrote. So it's not for my own discipline. Others I talked too long about some of these slides, and also just helped me to move through it. Pardon?
Let me run up and see.
Okay. South Africa lies at the tip of the African continent, the Cape of Good Hope, where the Atlantic and Indian Oceans meet. And of course, this is where the white people first landed in 1652. And as I mentioned here, South Africa, no I didn't, what is 1/7 the size of the United States. It's 1/7 the size. It's known as one of the most beautiful and at the same time one of the most troubled countries of our time. This is from Natal, in an area where the Lutheran Church, by the way, first started mission work back in the mid-1800s, the Norwegian Missionary Society. It has a population of about 36 million people, 87% black. If you take the black, the coloreds, all the people who are in so-called, quote, non-white, about 87%. For centuries, land has been one of the most controversial issues, since whites, who are 14-15% of the population, control 87% of the land. I'm not very good at the focus on this one, but I'm going to try it. Because I know that picture can be clear. Okay. This is the Orange Free State, by the way, which looks like parts of our western states. Homelands. The blacks have been relegated to home. Many blacks have been relegated to homelands where they're supposed to exercise their political rights. That was the theory. See, we have our rights in Johannesburg and Pretoria and Durban. You go back to KwaZulu, to Botswana, and there you will have your homelands and your political rights. For many, this meant the loss of South African citizenship, as I already mentioned. That was the Natal homeland. This is a Venda homeland. Dean Fersani, Danganeni Paswana, some of the people you know, the Venda homeland. For the most part, the homeland has some of the poorest land, and they have become increasingly overcrowded. And that's one of the differences from that I noticed from going back when we first came in the mid-50s, how much more overcrowded these areas are. They were not sufficient land even in the beginning. In recent years, malnutrition has dramatically increased in the homeland areas, such as this region in Natal. And they say that 1/3 of the black youth under 14 have diet deficiencies because it just isn't the land anymore.
That stuff in the foreground, the crop, or
that's dried corn. That's corn. Yeah, it's corn crop. They haven't harvested properly. That's a typical way of living in Natal, where people live in separate kraals or small homesteads. They don't live in villages. South Africa is one of the richest countries in the world, but wealth has been controlled largely by the whites. Blacks have provided cheap labor for the mines and industries, making South Africa, until recently, a profitable place for investors. Mine in the Transvaal. White capital and know-how, obviously, but black labor, so it made it a very, and the mines, some of the richest in the world, very sophisticated mining techniques and everything. Now this is an old picture, but this is called the Voortrekker Monument in Pretoria, because back around 1838, Afrikaner pioneers called trekkers pushed into the interior of South Africa in ox wagons, much as pioneers in the United States pushed westward. They also subdued or killed the local people. And this monument in Pretoria symbolizes this whole movement. You see the ox wagons around. They would put them in a logger, they call it, at night, circle the wagons. And you either subdued the indigenous people or you killed them all. Very similar to our history as we move west. An old sign, but Europeans only, Alleen Blancas, the two official languages, Afrikaans and English. This kind of party has gone now, like in parks and things like that. But this symbolizes the system. There was segregation from almost the beginning, but in later years the system became known as apartheid, and especially after 1948 a great deal of legislation was passed. Benches such as these are, you don't see, but the main pillars, as I said, are still in place, the main pillars of apartheid. And this sign on the edge of Soweto, as you're coming into Soweto, tells you that this road passes through proclaimed Bantu locations. Any person who enters a location without a permit renders himself liable to prosecution for contravening the Bantu Urban Areas Consolidation Act 1945 and the location regulations of the City Council of Johannesburg. And it's in four languages, Afrikaans, Sotho, and Zulu Xhosa. To just let you know that this is land for Africans, and you had to, you know, all the years we used to work in those places, work with African churches, you had to have a permit, or you could be, I mean, as it says, it was a criminal act to go in. Some days you went in without it, or you took people in without it, but that's to symbolize how the land, even in the urban areas, was divided up and set aside for the different groups. Well, Lumbuako Utula Pagati Bama Lokish Abansundu, Nomubani, Unganama Lokish, and Nanayo, Inwati Pemet, Yamvumelo, Uzi Bangela, Umangalero, Genga, Yogapula Umteto, Yendao, Zabansundu, Urban Areas Consolidation Act, so forth and so forth and so forth. Imteto, Yamalukish, Yumuzi was a Johannesburg. That's what the Zulu sounds like. Now you know what the science is. Based on the original Act of 1913, as I mentioned, the Group Areas Act then set aside areas for blacks and whites. Okay, the Population Registration Act meant that people were classified according to race, and this determined where you lived, where you could go to school, how you could work, and your political rights. The past laws, as I mentioned, have regulated the movement of black South Africans for years. Hundreds of thousands were arrested every year for past law offenses. These laws have been modified, but race classification is still in force. This is the old passbook, and every African had to have a passbook. And if you didn't have that on you, you'd just be thrown in jail. And there were raids for past law books, and there were people picked up on the streets. And if any of you have ever read the book Kaffir Boy, that's an autobiographical book by a young South African. I don't see it here in the library, but you can pick it up in the bookstore. That is the story of a young man, his own story as he grew up, and he tells in the very beginning of his house being bashed in the middle of the night, he's kicking down the door to ask his father and mother for those books. And if they weren't up to date, if you hadn't been up to date, you went into jail. So that was a pass. Nobody dared to go any place without a pass.
How long were they kept in jail for a pass offense?
Well, it could be weeks, it could be months. Then you had to get somebody to pay you to get out. Oh. Or you go to work, you work it off. A lot of people worked it off. That's how they got a lot of the cheap labor. The gangs you'd see out on the roads and, you know, I wouldn't call them chain gangs, but, you know, people doing work, they were working it off because they didn't have any money. Separate but unequal education was known as Bantu education. It was another pillar of apartheid. The per pupil expenditure for whites has been 5 to 7 times that for blacks. Some people say it's even higher, but it's always been separate but unequal education. And that's something, of course, that we know something, or at least it's not entirely foreign to us. Blacks have long resented this inferior type of education. When students in Soweto, took to the streets in June 16, 1976 to protest against Afrikaans as a medium of instruction. They were attacked by police and over 600, some say over 1,000, no one ever knows, were killed. This event is a historic watershed in black protest and resistance. You notice a picture up here, June 16th. And
what's the first name of the...
Hector Peterson. The first child that was killed that they were aware of. There were others. They were all school kids. As the government sought to control growing unrest in the 80s, thousands of blacks, tens of thousands were imprisoned, an estimated 51,000 between 1984 and 1989. And that happened to be in Durban. I was visiting, and didn't really need to be on the picture, but it's a list of people who were in detention at that time. Alan Busak, Paddy Kearney was a Catholic priest, Some were in for a few weeks, some were in for years. And this was just a partial list of some of the people that were in detention at that time. For years, political parties were banned, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. The ANC, as you know, was banned in 1960, so there was no way to express things peacefully. There were no political parties. We may say our parties aren't that relevant or helpful, but at least we have parties, and we can go to caucuses, and we can vote. There was nothing like it. 1986, a state of emergency was declared, and troops then went into the townships. And as police and army brutality and oppression increased, there were many types of other kinds of protests. This is a billboard protest, and very interesting, in Johannesburg, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, we were driving along the street and saw this billboard, kind of an out-of-way corner, kind of a main street, but sort of an out-of-way corner where a lot of people probably didn't notice it, and shows the white policeman, you know, shambucking these whips, an African, chasing the African, and then the symbolism, the bats and the snakes. 2 days later, that was gone. In recent decades, blacks have flocked to cities such as Cape Town in search of employment, like in other African places in America too, going to the cities. The land can't hold them, especially when you only got 13% of the land. Thousands lived in squatter camps, which were declared illegal and demolished by the government. You can see the bulldozers have come in and have just leveled that off, that side. But the desperate people came back again and again, shacks sprang up, and this is what's called Crossroads in Cape Town. They just came back, there was no place to go. And for many of them, their husbands had jobs in the city and they were supposed to go back over here, and they said, there's nothing back there. So they were illegal, so they'd hide in the bush sometimes during the day, they'd come at night, the shacks would be just demolished. Johannesburg, called the City of Gold by the Africans, Igoli, is the commercial and industrial center of southern Africa, not only South Africa, in the whole. It's a city probably of about 1 million or so, but then next to it you have Soweto with 2 million people. Soweto has over 2 million Africans. It's a segregated township outside of Johannesburg. You've heard about that many times. Things are changing somewhat now. Certain black people with enough money could move into certain parts of Johannesburg. All these years, you had to live here whether you wanted to or not, and you had to be married to have a house. Very difficult situation. And if you came from a rural, this is the resettlement. I think I got two slides turned around just doing it. Anyway, one of the other parts of the government's policy during these many years has been resettling people. And you see these arrows on this map. You can't see it now, but if there's a group of black people in a place that wasn't legally for blacks, they were called the blacks, but they were moved. Some of them were moved many, many miles in trucks. And 3.5 million black people have been moved from black spots. It'd be like if the state of Minnesota decided that all the Indians in Minnesota are going to be in one place, and they just haul them over there and put them there, and say, here's your place. This is Omverbach, or Botzabelo, in the Orange Free State. Again, you can see it looks like Western United States. 500,000 people live here. They've been removed by the government of South Africa from the whole Orange Free State province, which is a province in the middle of the country, in the middle here, to this area. And this is their place. If you're lucky enough to have a little money to build a little house, if you don't, you just build it whatever you can. And another part of the system is when you come into the city, these are the two, you cannot, if you come from a rural area, you come from a small town in Colorado, and you come to Denver, and you've got a job. You can't bring your wife into Denver because she belongs back there in the reservation. So she has to stay back there. Even if you had the money to bring her, you can't bring her. And you live in a hostel like this, a single-sex hostel. And if your wife wanted to come, she'd have to live in a single-sex hostel for women, or maybe she gets a job as a domestic, so-called domestic, and she could live in the backyard of a white family. But you could not live together, whether you wanted to or not. Single-sex hostels in Alexandria, outside of Johannesburg. In the resettlement areas, you get a small plot of ground, and you can build homes from your own resources. For most people, it just means tin shack. So in the resettlement areas, that's the way most people live. These are some kids who belong to a Lutheran congregation. Now, in this whole complex, and we've just touched the surface, but this very, very difficult situation, our sister church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa, called ELCSA, ministers, works, struggles to survive, lives, tries to help its people, provide strength and hope, and through its ministry. The leader of the church, the presiding bishop of the Church of Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa, is Bishop Solomon Sirota, grandson and wife up in northern Transvaal. The church has about 600,000 members. It has seven dioceses, seven bishops. In Natal, one of the bishops, Bishop Zulu, the man in the middle, the bishops are all African. There's one exception. There's a missionary kid that grew up, he used the word resistance. This was the headquarters of the South African Council of Churches and of the Lutheran Church, among other churches, right downtown Johannesburg, right downtown near the station. It was bombed mysteriously 1988 in August. A bomb was placed in the basement and blew out the whole inside of the building, ruined everything. So the Southern Council of Churches, the Lutheran Church, everybody had to move out. Everybody has found new places to live. They've never been able to find the reason for this. It's suspicious, very suspicious, that somehow the government knew at that time. Now, this wouldn't happen now. Government, anything related to government, this would not happen. It could be a far right group would do it, but whatever the reason, this is one of the ways in which the church was shown you better be careful and not be too outspoken. The church suffered in other ways. Dean Farsani on the left, Chinwana Farsani on the right. I mean, some of you know him well. He's been here, lived here, spoken. He was imprisoned four times, tortured two times. His book is also Diary of South African Prison. What is his book about the prison?
Torture.
South African pastor.
Torture of South Africa. Yeah, his book is in the bookstore. Small, very chilling book. Dean T.S. Farsani. The man on the left is Ndagalini Paswana, another Lutheran pastor who was with him and was tortured and detained. Just finished his studies now at Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia. The tall man is a German missionary who is treasurer of the diocese, and then Bishop Solomon Sirota, who is the bishop of that diocese and has also had his difficulties. He's been detained several times. The office has been ransacked and raided several times in the past years. Lutheran Church is found in rural areas, down in rural Natal. Some of the people worship in settings like this. In Soweto, Meadowlands, you see the mine dumps in the background. Looks like around here. When we go over here, he said, this looks like Johannesburg. Pretty nice church in Soweto and Diepkloof. All kinds of facilities for worship. In the resettlement area in the Orange Free State that I showed you just briefly, the kids standing by the shanty, this is a church built by funds from Canada, Germany, and the United States, and a creche on the right, a daycare nursery for children. Worship is a high point for black South, I mean, the Sunday, the churches are full, and they're singing and dancing and celebration in spite of, maybe because of, the suffering. And as Peter said in his Bible study, that gives hope and strength and helps people to be able to live through the next week. So you're amazed when you go to a church. I've seen people cry coming from the States, going to a place like that, and can't believe the vitality and the celebration in spite of all of this, and also the way in which they are welcomed by the people.
Come and say, well, we're white people. Maybe they don't want us to come. It's amazing the way you're received. Communion is a high spot. In fact, there's a word in Zulu when it's a communion Sunday, Lord's Supper Sunday, it's called Big Sunday, Sonto Likhulu. That's Bishop Dlamini, recently retired bishop in Zululand, Natal. Another very interesting part of worship is always a processional, every Sunday is a processional offering. They always come up to the front and bring their offering. They also have other offerings like we do. They have a harvest offering and a thanks offering or a building offering, but there's always a processional offering where people bring up their, and even though many of them are poor, this congregation is not as poor as many. Some of these people work in some of the offices there in the government, but you know, relatively a low income, and yet they bring offerings seeking to at least support the local ministry. And afterwards, a time of celebration and dancing and singing in many places, and that has grown a lot. It's been fun to see. There was a time when you weren't supposed to do those kind of African things in church, you know. That was supposed to be, had connotation with the past, but this is in Soweto, and they came out and they shook hands with everybody, and then some of the women got in the middle and started dancing. And processions and celebrations. I tell you, you have to go to Africa, and you don't have to only go to South Africa. You can go to any place in Africa. This was a church dedication 2 years ago in northern Transvaal. Jean Rapp, who's the past president of ALC or the ELCA Women, and I were at this place. It was a dedication that lasted 5 hours. We were in the church 5 hours before this started. Terrific. They had a band. They were German missionaries there at one time in the past. Wherever you had German missionaries, you have a brass band. That's great. they really know how to make that stuff sing, you know. Really, really fun. And there are some of the people coming into the service. And by the way, that service was 5 hours, but what made it bearable was, and I couldn't understand Sotho, I can understand Zulu, this was in Sotho. But the bishop's wife was very clever. At a dedication, every choir in the area sings. There were about 10 choirs, and every choir had to sing 2-3 times, and then everybody had to bring greetings. So she said, every time between a greeting and the choir, we'll stand up and dance. And then, and this, so this band played a certain song, and every time between the choir and the greeting, we stood up and moved around. Otherwise, you know, 5 hours of sitting would be on tiny little chairs, because they didn't have church benches yet, and they borrowed chairs from the school, little kids' chairs. You talk about celebration. Terrific. And the hospitality, African hospitality, wherever you go. If nothing else, you get fed. And, yeah, that's a church kitchen. That's a church kitchen. Not quite the same as ours, but the food is very good.
And so they were getting Lutheran hot dish there in the.
Well, it's South African Lutheran. It'd be rice and meat. A lot of rice there, and a lot of, in the homes it would be a lot of cornmeal. I mean corn, but at a celebration it would be rice and meat. Big hunks of meat and lots of rice.
Goat meat?
This was cow meat, cattle, I mean beef, but a lot of goat meat, a lot of goat meat. This symbol, a symbol of Amnesty International, is used by the churches in South Africa to remember people who are in detention, especially from their own congregations, and they have it on the altar. The churches in South Africa, and tomorrow, 2 days from now, we'll talk more about what the churches do. I should say that's on. Tomorrow I don't have anything. Friday, what the churches are doing. But anyway, refugees, what the churches are doing. And they have advice offices trying to help people, not only refugees, but homeless people, people without permits, people who lost their passes. They work together to help people. There's no money for lawyers. They don't have recourse to legal resources, so the churches, with some funding from overseas, try to provide. This is an advice office, an ecumenically run advice office in the Orange Free State, and these guys get put in jail very often. Tell them who that is, Arlene.
Oh, that's our son. Our son is a pastor in one of these resettlement areas.
Since we only got a couple of ELCA people serving in South Africa now, we can't avoid showing a picture of our son. There aren't many left. There are also, there are about, I should say about, we'll talk about the church, about 50 expatriate missionary types working in the church all over South Africa, from Germany and from the Scandinavian countries, and a couple from America. But these, this advice office, these guys get put in jail just because they're trying to help people and give advice. And one of the powerful things in the church in South Africa, as well as other places, are the women. They wear special uniforms. There they are dancing and singing after a meeting. They meet on Thursdays for Bible study and prayer, and then try to go out and visit. Some Thursdays they won't meet, they'll go out and visit sick people, or people who are bereaved, or people that they haven't seen come to church, or people that they think have special problems. The name that they use is Abasizigazi, which means the helping ones. And some of them also Abatandazi, the praying ones, to pray to help. Terrific thing in the situation. The visiting, this is kind of classic, but it shows what they do. I mean, they'll go into the hospitals, they'll go into the homes and pray with people, and it is by far the strongest organization in churches. In Swaziland, the women in that area, with some funds from the ALCW, just before the merger, the old ALC, gave funds through the Woman to Woman program. Some of you remember that. And the second person on the left is Jean Rapp. And on the right, you see Mary Lowe. I have another picture for Mary Lowe, is interning in South Africa. I believe, has been here, this place. She's a student at Luther Northwestern. And Nancy Hansen was a volunteer from the Twin Cities working in Swaziland. And a Swedish pastor. They were building the center as an educational center to teach better kinds of cooking, nutrition, raising crops, childcare, crafts, weaving, and so forth. So it's a very exciting project for them. And again, the women have been the spark plug. It's their project. Sunday schools, find in South Africa too, as well as every other place, trying to work. It doesn't always go so well, but there are Sunday schools attempts to work with the children. Youth movements in South Africa have a special significance that's quite different from here, when you think that some of these guys have been in jail because of the police came into this church. Again, it's a church in the Free State where a son is at. We have, you know, closer contact with that church. And they came in and took some of these guys and put them in jail.
Because of the t-shirt, Lutheran Youth?
No, because they felt that they were being subversive, and anyone who protests against some of the things the government are doing were subversive. Now, some of this is abating now, but I mean, they were doing nothing. They were not fomenting a rebellion or armed revolution, but they were, some of the people in that area were protesting some of the things the government was doing, and so some of them ended up in jail. One of the powerful means, again, is the singing and the dancing. A tremendous youth choir. I wish I could just get them on a plane and bring them over here. I don't think it's going to happen. From Northern Transvaal. They sang at this is the dedication. They were one of the choirs that had the dedication. But anyway, and the singing is a wonderful mix of gospel singing and protest songs and personal piety, and it's all there. It's tremendous. They go back and forth in a way that we can't. I mean, one song would really be, you know, literally overthrow the government. We want freedom, you know, down with apartheid. The next song would be, Jesus is my Savior, I love Him, I serve Him. It's again, part of the African holism, the holistic approach that Africans have that we'll talk about a little bit another day. The theological education, there are two seminaries in the church, at Umphumulu and Natal. One seminary, the chapel there, where the students gather, the faculty students gather for worship. There's been one ELCA person on the faculty. The faculty has Africans and expatriates. This was Ralph Ossing from the States, from our church. Some of you remember him. He worked with Lutheran Standard, for Lutheran Standard for a long time. Ralph, and he's written a lot of books. Ralph has retired, and we're in the process of replacing him at the church's request with another professor of biblical studies at Umphumulu. Marang, another important development in Upamulu, there are more women students there, 5 there out of 40 some now, which is good, and they do ordain women in that church. There are several ordained women pastors. This is a new women's dormitory built recently at Upamulu, with help from a number of churches from the partner churches in Europe and America. Just when I was there last year, they were just finishing. They hadn't moved in yet.
Is South Africa one of the few areas where they ordain women pastors? Is South Africa one of the few areas?
Yes, it's coming slowly. Tanzania just voted to do it now, to ordain the Church of Tanzania. Liberia, some of the others are struggling. In Namibia, the Church of the North, Bishop Dumaney's church, as we call it, does not ordain. The Church in the South, with Bishop Frederick and Deputy Bishop Kamita, ordains women. It's coming. There are not many, but there are a number of theologically trained women in these churches, more and more, and they're the ones that say, you know, we should be ordained. So it's coming, and the pressure is building up. This is the other seminary in Marang, north of Johannesburg. The seminaries divide up. It's part of the several years at one, several years at the other. It's an attempt to combine two seminaries and yet use the facilities of both. So churches try to get involved in a number of things. This happens to be garden projects in one church, trying to help the people who live in these small places with not much chance to do anything, to grow a few vegetables or a fruit tree or something, just as a little help for you and a sign of hope in the midst of the barrenness. One of the exciting things the church has done there is to develop a what's called an arts and crafts center in the town of Rorschach, where women come in, men and women, mostly women, and already have the skill but are trained in weaving and in pottery, which is something they already have, but to refine it. And they have won international prizes in both tapestry and pottery in some international exhibitions. Some of this is displayed, for instance, at Lutheran Northwestern Seminary, some large tapestries, and you'll see it in some other places. Beautiful stuff. And this tapestry is also done by them. This happens to be the installation of Bishop Flamini, who now is retired, but you see the new bishop in the middle there. This was done by people at that Arts and Crafts Center. Most of the weavers are women. Many of them are women who probably had only 3, 4, 5 years of school, but tremendously talented. Now, day school, day nurseries are run by some of the churches because in many places the people live many, many miles from work, and the fathers may be away at the mines. They're probably not home at all. The mothers get up early in the morning, often before dawn, and take a bus 30 miles into town and come back late at night. So if you can provide something for the children in the meantime, a place to have a little bit of food and to sing a song and just have a place to be. Church also runs one home for the aged. Now this is a new thing. You see, in the traditional society, it was built in social security in each village, in each kraal. The young people, the mentally afflicted or whatever, the aged, they're all cared for in the kraal or in the village, as the case may be. Now they have some of the same, there's no, how many places cannot take care of their aged parents, so they have homes for, not enough homes, but the church does have a home in the top to help some of the people. The history of our involvement as an American church goes back, as I mentioned, into the mid-1800s when the Norwegian missionaries came, and then later on the Americans got involved in it, and in 1928 American missionaries came over and began to work. And we don't have any there, as I said, right now. Mary Lowe, in the middle end, is an intern. We've tried to have one intern there each year. Next year, another person that some of you know, Ann Sipolin, is going out. In fact, now she's going. I hope she's got her visa. She's going to be an intern. Interesting enough, we've had 4 interns in that church, and 3 have been women. And most of our intern candidates the last few years for South Africa or for that area have been women. And there she's with her 2 supervisors, Swedish pastor Colleen on the left and Jerry Makagula, her dean, and her supervisor on the right. This was taken just last September. I arrived in Swaziland the same day she did. In fact, we flew together from Johannesburg. And the Woman to Woman project, which has had several phases, that's the woman from down there who came last time, Priscilla Zaniso, we met her, and she had her little, those of you remember that logo, and Linda Tiedemann, who's working in the Global Education Office of Chicago. We don't have a picture of the new one. That's another reunion, Jean Rapp, past president of the ELCA Women, with Noma Mohale. Noma and her husband studied in Columbus, and her husband, they're back in South Africa, and they had met in the States at a meeting, so they had a reunion there in South Africa. Unexpected. There's a new companion synod program that is being developed by the ELCA. Some of you are involved in that. Maybe some of you. How many people here are aware of their synod having a companion church someplace else in the world? Anybody? Okay, where is yours? You know, where is yours? Which church do you have overseas?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But I know we have one.
Okay, good. Chicago is going to be linked up with Johannesburg. Very interesting. And it just happened that when we were there that spring in South Africa. We were there in October. Bishop Hicks on the right, some of you know him, Bishop Sherman Hicks, met with Bishop Mondes Buthelezi, the man in the middle, in Soweto. Because they're going to have a partner church relationship. Now the hope is that every synod in the ELCA will have a partner, a sister church, or sister diocese somewhere in the world. We met in Soweto. I should explain, in case maybe you aren't wondering, but Bishop Hicks was on his way to the airport, so he apologized as soon as he arrived, because South Africans are quite formal, and everybody there that day had clericals on or, you know, was dressed up, and he was on his way to the airport, so he said, these are my traveling clothes. But there we met, and so they're setting up their companion. In Natal, the Southwestern Minnesota Synod is related to Natal, and that was an exciting thing because this pastor, the man on the right, Timothy Mieni, said, we want a partnership, and what we want most is someone to come and spend some months with us who has a gift of evangelism, just to live with us and encourage us. We're trying to do evangelism and we get discouraged, and can't you send someone just to encourage you? That was fun to hear. There was a consultation last year between the church leaders and partner churches. There have been many ties. Some of you probably won't recognize her because she was so thin. When her husband was still in prison. And we visited there, and Bishop Chilstrom, we met with Mourier for a couple hours. You won't recognize her, you know. They were here earlier this year, staff people will remember her. But, you know, it's a terrible time. Husband in detention for 2 years, in the solitary part of that time. So we had a chance to visit with her. That's just a symbol of some of the time. Churches continue to ask for our partnership, ask for our prayers, ask for our involvement. That's a church in Alexandria near Johannesburg. The future is still very, very uncertain. There are some tremendous hurdles to go through. There have been some exciting changes, as I said earlier, the release of Mandela, the unbanning, the beginning of the talks. So we hope that the future now will begin to unfold, but lots of hurdles and barriers that have to be overcome on the way. In the midst of all this, our sisters and brothers continue to serve, to struggle, to seek to stay alive, and to also to provide hope to one another. This is a new church in Transvaal, in fact, the one where we sat for 5 hours. Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. That's the motto they decided to use for their church, Acts 16:31. So, I didn't know what we did. Didn't leave much time for questions now, but there will be the two sessions on one, how did South Africa get that way, some perspectives, and then what about the church in the throes of apartheid? And then tonight the forum. But if you want to ask a couple questions before you run off. Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned that you're in a lot of Zulu areas. How does the church kind of match up with Chief Buthelezi and his opposition to the main ANC?
That question about Chief Gotcha Buthelezi is a very good question, and I can just touch on it now, but it's very relevant because Buthelezi
is right in the area where the Lutheran Church is very strong. And he has become increasingly problematic, even to our Lutheran Church. Now, in 1970, when the first Zulu bishop was installed, Buthelezi was a speaker at the bishop's installation. You know, there was and there was a pretty close tie between him and the Lutheran Church even then. He's Anglican, by the way. Some of you probably know that. And he has been an active Anglican layperson. I mean, quite active. Now he's becoming increasingly difficult, and maybe tonight we'll touch on that again. The Inkatha movement has divided the Zulu people, and the violence in Natal is not between different ethnic groups, it's between Zulus. And he stands for one side. So it's making it, Natal, where the Lutherans are very strong, is right now the killing field of South Africa. So, and he's involved in this. Now, Buthelezi would never say, let's have someone killed, but the Inkatha movement is certainly behind some of this. So it is a real problematic thing. And there are Lutheran pastors who cannot conduct funerals for some of their members in certain parts. If that member was, say, an Inkatha member, they're in danger of their lives. They're told sometimes not to go into other areas. So, I mean, that's just a quickie. We can talk a little bit more about it later. But it's difficult. It's real difficult. And he has ostracized more and more people. He has, one of his chief lieutenants has just left, Oscar Dlomo, probably his right-hand guy, a very articulate man, has left. And they say it's because he doesn't want to go along with him anymore. He's becoming more defensive. It's a real problem. So maybe I can leave it there now because of time, but it's a real difficult one. And he and Mandela were together, you know, as in the Fort Hare and in the ANC Youth League, they were friends. And I think those two can still maybe talk, but there's so much other stuff in the way. Okay, yes?
What's the status of integration in the Lutheran Church in South Africa?
Well, if you want to talk about, there is a white Lutheran church, and we can talk about that and talk about church. The white Lutheran church and the black Lutheran church. The black Lutheran church is 600,000, the white church is about 30,000. They're mostly from German background. They're talking about getting together, but there's no, they're not together. And they're most, the Germans live here and here and here, and the black people over here. There is very little integration in that sense. There is a very interesting congregation right in the middle of Johannesburg, which was started by Tom Solner. Some of you know Tom, and he's been here. He's a Washington from Port Angeles. That's integrated. It's a small congregation right in the middle of the city where people can come from different parts of the city. But otherwise, you go to a German Lutheran church, it's Germans, and you go out to Soweto, it's blacks. And they are talking about getting together. But you know, the Lutheran churches were suspended from the Lutheran World Federation, the whites, I mean, because they didn't agree to join. So that's a problem that the Lutherans have. Okay, I think we better stop now and then pick it up again. It's Thursday and Friday. There'll be two other sessions on South Africa. Watch the Wolf War.